Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Homeless advocates filed a lawsuit against the city of Sacramento with the goal to prevent an anti-camping measure from appearing on the November ballot. Voters would decide whether to approve an ordinance that would outlaw homeless encampments once the city creates enough shelter spaces or safe ground camping sites. This measure is a compromise to a more aggressive version business leaders proposed. But this lawsuit to pull the so-called Emergency Shelter and Enforcement Act of 2022 is running against a quickly approaching deadline. Joining us now is CAP Radio's Sacramento government reporter, Kristen Lamb. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
Well, let's start off with a debrief. What is this measure? What would it actually do if voters pass it?
Yeah, so it could ban homeless encampments on public property and require the city to build shelters. Unhoused people camping on city streets would face a misdemeanor if they reject offers for available emergency shelter space. But before that would happen, the measure requires the city to create thousands of shelter spaces or outdoor safe ground camping sites.
Okay, so shelter would need to be created first before there would be any potential infractions. The city council approved this measure to go to the November ballot. When did they approve this?
The council first approved the measure back in April. It was a compromise for a more aggressive proposal that business leaders filed paperwork for back in February. And that group, the Sacramentans for Safe and Clean Streets and Parks, withdrew their proposal after working with the council on the compromise. Last week, the council made a couple technical changes to the measure. One change was adding a condition that would only go into effect if the city and county reach a partnership agreement on homeless services.
Now let's get into the lawsuit. Why is the group of advocates for unhoused residents suing?
They say it's illegal and unconstitutional. They also say it criminalizes homelessness and would add further financial burdens on people experiencing poverty. And they say it's harmful just appearing on the ballot and that it intensifies public opposition to providing housing for people who can't afford traditional homes. Attorney Mark Marin explained the reasoning for the lawsuit at a press conference Tuesday.
It's so burdensome, so ridiculous, so abhorrent that we decided, that is, these organizations that we represent, decided that it should not even be put before the people for a vote. And it's an extreme measure to take an ordinance that has been passed by a public entity and nip it in the bud and say it's so abhorrent, it's so obviously illegal, it's so unconstitutional that it should not even burden the people, and it shouldn't. We shouldn't have to go out there and oppose it. So we should cut it off at the pass. And that's what we're trying to do.
So, Kristen, this lawsuit cites a federal ruling in Martin versus Boise. It's a case that dates back to 2018. And it really was a landmark ruling protecting the rights of the unhoused community. How does this decision come into play?
So a U.S. Court of Appeals judge made a ruling in Martin v. Boise, and that lawsuit challenged the city of Boise's anti-camping ordinance. In the ruling, a judge said that as long as there are more homeless people in an area than there are indoor shelter beds, governments can't criminally punish people for sitting, lying, or sleeping in public. So if there aren't enough indoor beds, governments can't criminalize people for sleeping outdoors on public property. And the U.S. Supreme Court let that decision stand in 2019. Right now, Sacramento has more homeless people than beds, so activists believe they can apply Martin v. Boise in this situation. Plus, the measure proposes banning homeless encampments once there are enough shelter spaces for at least 60% of the unhoused population living in the city. That might also conflict with the Boise case.
Yeah, 60% is less than 100%. What does the city have to say about the lawsuit?
So the city attorney didn't have a statement on Tuesday, but the proponents of the original proposal said that they were disappointed by the effort to prevent voters from having the chance to weigh in. Daniel Conway is the chair of the Sacramentans for Safe and Clean Streets and Parks. In a statement that he sent me, he said that the measure would provide safe shelter space and ensure that everyone in the community has access to safe public spaces.
Yeah, and this one issue is part of a broader issue when it comes to the unhoused community, which is a crisis. And I guess, what is the broader argument that proponents for this measure say that the measure is needed to solve this crisis?
Yeah, so one of their main points is that they say that homelessness is a public safety issue. They point to anecdotes of drug use or incidents of fires that start at encampments. And they also say that the measure can help support small businesses. Some businesses have called into meetings saying that they moved because of people sleeping in the streets and leaving trash, keeping customers away. Proponents of this measure say it's time for a new approach. Amanda Blackwood, president of the Sac Metro Chamber, is part of the coalition supporting the measure. Our colleague, CAP Radio reporter Chris Nichols, spoke with Blackwood about 2 weeks ago.
A 67% increase in your most vulnerable population is unacceptable. To continue to fight for the status quo way of addressing it is illogical. We must now move forward in a new way, in an aggressive way, and I very much share the mayor's belief that if folks aren't mandated to do the right thing, you often find that they don't, because priorities shift. So, you know, it is essential that we codify this language through the measure now, so that as that council changes and as those priorities change, the commitment to housing the unhoused does not change. And the commitment to providing what needs to be done so they can move forward in their lives does not change. And the commitment to public safety does not change.
And when Amanda Blackwood is talking about that 67% increase, she's referring to the spike in Sacramento's homelessness population. What are the latest numbers on the unhoused community?
Right. Blackwood referenced the latest point in time count. The 2022 count found that about 9,300 unhoused people live in Sacramento County. That's a 67% increase since 2019. That was when the last count happened. The report also again found that the vast majority of people experiencing homelessness are from Sacramento County. Only about 5% surveyed said that they moved to the county in the last 6 months.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio Sacramento government reporter Kristen Lamb about a last-ditch effort by advocates for those experiencing homelessness to block a ballot measure that would ban camping on city streets. So when it comes to shelter spaces, because that is really crucial for this measure, how many shelter spaces does Sacramento have right now?
The city has about roughly 1,100 shelter spaces, and they're typically full on any given night. Advocates also say that there's a number of reasons why shelters don't work for some unhoused individuals, like some might have had a bad experience at a shelter or not want to be separated from family.
And 1,100 shelter spaces with a point in time count from this year that is over 9,000 in Sacramento County. When it comes to the coalition of homelessness advocates that are participating or in support of this lawsuit, who are they?
Yeah, there are five nonprofit groups involved. One is Sacramento Area Congregations Together. Then there's the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness, Sacramento Housing Alliance, Organize Sacramento, and the Sacramento Homeless Union.
And the Sacramento Homeless Union also has a case, and they're cited in this lawsuit, as you just mentioned, but it's titled Sacramento Homeless Union versus the County of Sacramento. What's this lawsuit about?
So the city of Sacramento is also a defendant in the case. A federal judge last month issued a temporary ruling or injunction that prevents Sacramento from clearing homeless encampments until August 25th. That's a week from now. The homeless union argued that the city and county have failed to provide enough cooling centers during extreme heat. The attorney for the homeless union, Anthony Prince, told me that they plan to ask for the temporary ban on sweeps to be extended.
Yeah, because that will expire in about a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the issue of housing first, there's the argument among homelessness advocates where they argue that this measure doesn't prioritize housing. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, so some advocates really emphasize the housing first approach. That approach says that people need a safe and stable place to live before they can get back on their feet. Like, once they have housing, the argument is that they can get treatment, improve their health, and get more income, like through a job. And Crystal Sanchez is the president of the Sacramento Homeless Union. Sanchez touched on the housing issue at a press conference Tuesday.
This ballot measure does not create housing, nor is there a guarantee that the county will provide the wraparound services. The ballot measure will bankrupt the city due to lawsuits, the ability to provide the spaces, and challenges as to what it may look like. It will also challenge. It will also be challenged by our neighborhoods, as we have seen with all other solutions. Neighborhoods don't want them in their backyard. The ballot initiative wants people to believe that this is about shelter. This is not about shelter. This is about removing people out of sight, out of mind.
All right. So this lawsuit wants to get the measure pulled. As it stands, the measure will be on the November ballot. What needs to happen for that not to happen?
So a county judge would have to rule that the measure is illegal and order the city to not put it before voters. But there's only about 2 weeks for that to happen. County elections spokesperson Jana Hayes told me that a judge would need to make the order by the end of the month. Otherwise, the county will have already finished the election guide with the measure on it.
That is not a lot of time. Is a hearing for the lawsuit scheduled?
Yeah, it's scheduled for next week on August 23rd. In that hearing, a city could explain how the measure does not violate the law, and a judge would then decide whether to order the city to remove it from the ballot.
What happens if the group loses the lawsuit against the city?
Then voters will determine the measure's fate this November as planned. The measure requires a simple majority vote to pass.
Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Lam is Cap Radio's Sacramento government reporter. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sacramento County has elected a new district attorney. Tian Ho has been with the Sac County DA's office for nearly two decades, known for prosecuting the Golden State Killer trial, conviction, and sentencing of Joseph DeAngelo, also known as the East Area Rapist. But to some residents, he may be an unfamiliar name. I sat down with District Attorney-elect Tian Ho about his lived experiences that shaped a career in law, and what the county's 1.5 million residents can expect from its top prosecutor. So I want to go back to May when Cap Radio asked you why you decided to run for office. You said the where answers the who and ultimately answers the why. Mm-hmm. So I want to get into the who and the where of Tian Ho.
So let me kind of just talk about in terms of who, because I think where we grow up, where we came from, our families, our communities that we grow up in really kind of shape who we are and our future. So I was actually born in Vietnam. And as many people know, in 1975, when South Vietnam fell to the communist North, the communists came in and they arrested my uncle who worked for the South Vietnamese government. Without a jury, without a judge, without a prosecutor, they sent him to a re-education camp in the jungle where he was tortured for 7 years. So in 1976, when I was almost 5 years old, my parents decided that we needed to escape Vietnam. So my mom and my dad, along with some of their friends and families, about 30, 40 people, they pull their money together to buy a fishing boat. A couple of days before we escape, I'm sitting there and I noticed that my dad had taken my favorite toy in the whole wide world, which is this little plastic gun, and he was painting it black. And so I'm like, Dad, what are you doing? And he just laughed. Well, my dad also stole a uniform from a communist officer. So the night that we escaped from Vietnam, they took my two-month-old brother, put him in a cardboard box and punched holes in it so he could breathe. We snuck aboard the boat, about 40 of us, 30, 40, and we're all below decked, except for my dad, who's up on deck with the captain. My dad's wearing the stolen officer uniform and the fake gun in the holster. So you have to go through these series of checkpoints in the Delta to get out to sea. Along the way, we got stopped at a military checkpoint. And the guard asked my dad, why are you out here? Dad says, oh, I just bought this boat from this captain here. I'm on a cruise checking out the boat with my wife and my two boys who are below deck. And the guard says, no, I think you have a bunch of refugees below, and I want to search right here, right now. My dad looked at him. He says, all right, go ahead. Look, if you find a bunch of refugees, and there's like 40 of us, if you find a bunch of refugees, you can kill all of us, starting with me. But if you look down there and all you see is my wife and my two boys, I'm going to take this gun, and he's pointing to the fake plastic gun, and I'm going to blow your brains out. How dare you even question me? I outrank you. And he's pointing to the stolen uniform. So my dad, he had never gambled in his life before until that moment. So the guard kind of looked at my dad for a moment, kind of paused, looked around, and then he said, nah, we don't need to look. Why don't you come back here for a drink? And if you know anything about Vietnamese people, we love our cognac. So they're having cognac back there, and we're all below deck freaking out. My dad made it back. We made it out to sea. The problem was the captain of the boat, his family got stuck on shore. So he jumped off the ship, and he swam back, and he left us. So now they have to make a decision. We're trying to make it across the South China Sea to the Philippines. And nobody on that boat knew how to navigate the open sea. My dad was a school teacher. So they were talking, maybe we should turn back. But if you turn back and you got caught, you're dead. So they decided to make a run for it. Well, we ran out of gas, ran out of food, ran out of water. We're just drifting on the ocean aimlessly for almost 3 weeks until we were rescued by a French merchant ship. Took us to a refugee camp in Malaysia. So we were sponsored, my family and I, my parents and I, to Stockton. And when we moved to Stockton, lived in a little apartment off of Hammer Lane. We didn't even have a bed to sleep on, so my dad said, all right, let's go. My dad and I found a mattress somebody threw away next to the garbage bin. That's what the four of us slept on. I didn't know how to speak English at all. So I learned how to speak English by watching Bugs Bunny cartoons. 22 years later, graduated from law school. And so when I look back at my family's history, whether it was my grandmother who was executed by the communists without a judge, jury, or prosecutor, whether it was my uncle who was taken and sent away and tortured without a judge, jury, or prosecutor, one of the reasons about why I decided to become a lawyer and to run for district attorney is that the district attorney is the gatekeeper to our system of justice. We're the first and last person to ever see a case. And we are there to make sure that the system of justice treats everybody equally and fairly. And this country has afforded myself and my family all the opportunities and the freedoms in the world. And it gets to a certain point that you have to give back to the community.
The fact that you are the first person of color to be a district attorney in Sacramento County, and you just shared a very powerful lived experience at such a young age, not even 5 years old. What do you think that adds to the role of leading the county as the top prosecutor?
You know, I think we are shaped by our life experiences. I'm an immigrant, a refugee. I'm a person of color. I had to learn English. I grew up poor, worried about where the next meal was coming from. It gives me a perspective of that. In addition, I've also been a victim of violent crime. My family, we were victims of an attempted home invasion robbery. I've been a victim of a drive-by shooting. So I know what it's like to be a victim of a crime. And when you look at crime, you know, it disproportionately affects people from marginalized communities. It's particularly violent crimes. It's not affecting to the same degree those that live behind, you know, a gated community somewhere with guards. No, it affects the vast majority of the people, and in particular people from marginalized communities. And so when we're talking about crime, when we're talking about public safety, we have to make sure that we look at it in that sense as well. And as somebody who, and I've given the statistic out before, there are approximately 2,400 elected district attorneys across the entire country. And of that, there are only 8, and I will be the 9th current, that are of API descent. And so we talk about making sure that we have a seat at the table, or else you end up on the menu. Mm-hmm. But I think you need to take it to another level. You not only need to have a seat at the table, you need to have a voice at the table to determine what is on the menu, right? So that you can have a say in policy decision-making in terms of shaping the culture, the view of the office, and public safety for all communities, and making sure that everyone feels included and that everyone feels safe, because public safety is a right that is entitled by all communities, not just some communities. And it's both those who are accused of crimes, but those that are victims of crimes. We can't forget both of those sides.
So you're the 9th now. Currently, I want to go back to 1998 when you became a prosecutor. How was being a member of the AAPI community How was that like, really being a minority in a field that was, I'm going to go, likely white and male, most likely at that time? Well, did you receive any resistance?
So I can tell you that among my colleagues in the DA's office, it was welcoming. It was inclusive. You have your bands of, your band of brothers and sisters there, going through the process, helping the community. None there at all. But what you do notice is that I have very few role models growing up in the legal profession. I didn't know anybody who was a lawyer in my family. And even in the community, there was maybe one, but that was it. So there's no, where do you look for in terms of a role model? Where do you look for in terms of what to model yourself, to look at, to have goals, mentorship? There was none. And so, if you remember, Michael Jordan, he had a slogan, be like Mike, right? And so there was nobody to be like. And so the only thing that you could be at the end of the day, and I think it was good for me, was to be myself. And I think as you go through life, you have to find your own voice and identity. I will say this, that, there's an interesting story when we talk about in terms of just perception. So I've been a prosecutor here in Sacramento for almost 20 years. And so a couple of years ago, I was now worked my way through the office, and I am now the supervisor of the gang team, one of the most elite teams in the office, the supervisor of the major narcotic team of the hate crime unit. And I'm wearing a suit and tie. I'm walking down the hallway in the courthouse, suit and tie, supervisor, been there for years, tried, nearly 100 jury trials or 100 trials. And so I'm walking down and I have some defense attorney yelling out at me. And he says, "Are you the interpreter?" And as I get closer and I'm ignoring him, I'm trying to stay calm. "Are you the interpreter?" I don't say anything. And he starts screaming, "Are you the Chinese interpreter?" And so I get right up to him, and he's like yelling at me now. And I said, "I am not the effing interpreter," right? And so, there is that perception. Is somebody else who is not Asian going to get that comment? I mean, I've been working here 18 years. I'm in this position, and yet I'm still viewed by this defense attorney as the interpreter. So when we talk about making history, when we talk about the position of the district attorney, there are only 58 in the entire state. I think it is a monumental achievement for the community. I'm not focused on the individual, but for the community. I think it's important.
When talking about the community, you were the lead prosecutor of one of the largest criminal cases in California history, the Golden mm-hmm. State Killer, East Area Rapist. I covered that trial until the sentencing. You've said in the past that when you reflect on this, you don't think about the national media attention mm-hmm. or the documentaries, but how do you reflect on this period in your career?
So I'll tell you a little bit about one story that I think really resonated with. Joseph DeAngelo killed 13 people. Raped upwards of 50 people, committed 120 burglaries in 11 jurisdictions up and down the state of California. His reign of terror was pervasive. He is the worst of the worst. He is a monster. And so as we were looking at the case, we sought the death penalty. And there are strong disagreement and passionate disagreement among some people in regards to the death penalty. But I thought if anybody ever deserved the death penalty, it was him. And for all the wreck and the carnage and the pain that he caused. And as we were proceeding on the case, I believed that he deserved it. And at one point, we took it off the table. And initially, I was against it. Because if anybody deserved it, it was him. And then what happened was, as we go to court, and I'll paint the scene for you. Very first day we go to court, that I go to court after getting assigned the case, there was a lady that walked up to me. Her name is Phyllis, and she's identified herself, and she was on TV and in the media. She was the very first sexual assault victim in Sacramento and Rancho Cordova. So Phyllis would come up. She introduced herself, shake my hand, and every single time she would be there, every time she would shake my hand, every time I sit down and I catch up with her, how are you doing, Phyllis? This is what's going on today, and this is what's going to happen. And then I talked to her afterwards. Every single time she was there. And near the end of the case, she can't, what happened was she wasn't there anymore. She had cancer. She was diagnosed with cancer, and she was going through chemo and radiation. And there was this empty seat every time in court. And so as we were getting ready to resolve the case, and he pled guilty to all these counts of murder, admitted committing all these rapes and these crimes, and he's going to go away forever. multiple life without the possibility of parole sentences forever. And so we're in the Sac State Ballroom because we're in the middle of COVID in 2020. You had to be 6 feet apart. And mind you, we have
I remember I was there.
You were there. We had so many victims, right? And so many people from the media, the police, everybody. And we couldn't just fit in a courtroom, and you had to, we needed to give the victims a place and an opportunity to be there and get closure in their life. And so when you take a plea, you have to read the factual basis of what the defendant did in that particular case. And so for each one of the cases, each victim stood up on their case. But because Phyllis was going through chemo and radiation, she couldn't be there. So when it was time for the factual basis for her plea, all the other victims stood up for her. That was such a moving moment. Now, fast forward about maybe 2 months, 2.5 months later. We're back in the Sac State Ballroom. He's about to get sentenced and sent off to prison. I don't know if you, were you there then?
Yeah, I was there.
I'm sitting there. I'm kind of watching the entire ballroom. And I'm sitting on the left as you're facing the stage. And I look over to my right, way over on the other side. And I see Phyllis. And she had this beautiful, beaming smile on her face. A few months later, she passed away from cancer. So if we had sought the death penalty, if we had kept going on the case, she would have never gotten her day in court, never gotten that closure before she passed away. And so many of these other victims. And so when I think about the case, I think about the detective that when he retired, became a private investigator and was following people, trying to look down leads. I think about the law enforcement officers and the other people that never gave up on the case and kept working on it to find closure, to bring them to justice and give closure, some measure of it to each of these victims and to Phyllis. And so when I think about it, I think of Phyllis. That's what I think of.
During that period in the last 6 years, another major assignment that the district attorney's office also took on was mm-hmm. whether to charge the officers in the shooting death of Stephon Clark. District Attorney Schubert mm-hmm. ultimately decided not to. During mm-hmm. your campaign, Cap Radio asked you about that. You said it was extremely tragic. Mm-hmm. It was heartbreaking. But ultimately, the DA's decision was evaluated. It was upheld at both the state and the federal level. But I'm just curious, because you also are an adjunct professor, so mm-hmm. you teach law. Mm-hmm. You also have more than 20 years of experience as a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile following the facts and the law when the outcome is also extremely tragic and heartbreaking?
You know, I prosecuted sex crimes for many years. Child molestation cases, rape cases, they take an emotional toll on you. We're human beings. It's very difficult to separate your emotions, but you have to do so because justice requires it. The victim requires it. The defendant who is possibly accused of a crime requires it. You don't want somebody making a decision about life and death, about prison, about jail, about justice, about freedom, about liberty, about all those things based on emotion. And we are emotional creatures. That's who we are. That's what separates us from a rock that sits in my backyard. And it gives us our humanity. And we must never lose touch with our humanity. But when it comes to the analyzing something, you have to look at the facts and the law. That's where it starts. That's where it ends. But all around it, in terms of how you deal with people and how you talk to people, that's where the humanity and the empathy always comes in, and the understanding of where it fits into our community.
Are the laws limiting, though, and would you like them to be improved in this case? And it's not isolated. He was unarmed and running away from officers.
You know, if we were to talk about that case, and remember, every single case, you have to look at the facts of every single case. He was running away from officers. But at that point in time, if you're looking at it just from a legal analysis, and you watch the video, at that point, he was advancing on the officers. At that moment, right before the shots were fired, he was in a position with his hands up, and then he advanced on the took, when I say advance, and
right, it wasn't here, like he did not yes, charge. It so, was, I think it's so, a very slight movement so, when you watch the video.
I think when we say, now I'm using legal terms, not legal terms, but jargon. So let me kind of just use simple term. He moved towards, okay, whether it was however far, it was visible in terms of a movement towards. So advance is probably too technical of a term. And so you have to look at all that. So whether you look at the law or not, at the end of the day, it's the facts of the case really drives every single case is what it is. And, you know, those things are heartbreaking for the community. And you always have to recognize that for first and foremost, for his family, for anybody's, you know, family.
And this is just one example. There are other examples as well, not only in Sacramento, across the country. There is a reckoning that's bringing people out onto the streets for racial justice, some advocating for police reform. What do you take from that as a prosecutor when some would argue that that trust is being fractured, especially with underserved communities?
I think one of the things is, and I feel it and I sense it and I see it and I hear it in terms of fractured trust with certain communities, particularly marginalized communities. And those communities are also the ones that are most affected by crime as well, both as defendants and victims of crimes. So how do you bridge that trust and that gap, right? So one of the ideas that I have, and we currently don't have this in place, is I want to have an advisory council. So the vision is to have a large advisory council, but I think that we need to have smaller advisory councils, perhaps one for the Asian community, one for the Latino community, one for the African-American community, maybe the business community, LGBTQ, different communities. And they each have, remember, we are unique in terms of our experiences. We have a lot in common, but sometimes they're unique and different. So each of those committees will then pick somebody themselves, vote somebody to sit on the larger council, right, that will then have an advisory role with myself as the district attorney so that I have an opportunity not to talk, but to listen. And I think that we need to do more listening. And if we do a lot of listening and engagement in that sense, and being out in the community and also having the community with us, I think that's the first step in terms of bridging trust is seeing each other more, talking to each other more, listening to each other. It's a very basic human thing. If you and I have talked like 6-12 times, by the end of it, we're going to have a level of just commonality and familiarity that so we can have a conversation and talk about things openly and address things. And so I think that it starts first there because I do sense that gap that needs to be bridged.
The fact that you've been with the Sacramento County District Attorney's Office for nearly 20 years, I believe you joined in 2004, what should residents expect? Will this be a continuation of a district attorney's office under DA Schubert?
I think that one of the things that we do and we do well is prosecute violent crimes. We've done that, and I've done that consistently over time as well. But there are things that, you know, such as the advisory council that I want to institute. Another idea that I've had that I've talked about is a form of a neighborhood court for low-level offenses. Yolo County has such a program. I also want to work and expand in terms of juvenile work, especially in the areas with trades and training and foster kids to get them some sort of vocational training while they're in the system so that when they time out of the system or they're off probation, that they have a hope in the future and how we can collaborate with the schools on that and the school board and juvenile hall and the trades. There's different things there. And the other thing is at some point, it's not at some point, we need to address the homeless crisis. We all see it. We all feel it. First and foremost, I believe that homelessness should not be criminalized. But I think there's an intersection there when we come with mental health and drug addiction and public safety. How do we deal with that? How do we help those that are going through mental health and drug addiction and some that commit crimes? How do we deal with that to make sure that there is a path towards rehabilitation? And so I don't know if we talked about this last time, but we have a program at the DA's office called the CORE program, C-O-R-E. What that is if you have somebody, and they don't have to be homeless, but let's say they have 10 offenses or more. It could be trespassing, it could be battery, it could be vandalism. Each in these cases individually on their own because of the changes in the law don't amount to much in terms of sentencing. But what happens if they have 10 or more, and we have some that have many, many more? And what's fueling it could be drug addiction and mental health. And it's that vicious cycle. Was it the mental health that caused the drug addiction? Was it the drug addiction that caused the mental health? Who knows? But at the end of the day, they have both. And some of it spirals out into criminal activity. And so if they have 10 or more offenses, what we do is we work with law enforcement. We try to offer services first. And then what we do is if they have 10 or more offenses, they are at that point taken to jail. And so then what we do is we work with their defense attorney and the court. And we say, look, you can deal with these 10 cases because now there are 10 cases and stay in jail, or you can go into a drug treatment program. We find out what is the underlying causality of the criminogenic behavior. And if it's drug addiction, you can go into a drug treatment program, or you can stay. Which one would you want? Okay, I want the drug treatment program. So what we do, and we did it recently, we had the sheriff's department take that individual and transport them to the drug treatment program. Now, if they run, they escape, they don't finish the program, they go back to jail and they have to deal with the case. But if they finish it, then they don't do another day of jail. They get put on probation and make sure that we try to get them services and continue services on it. But that is a process that we're trying to work on. Now, one of the issues we're running across is, and I know Governor Newsom is looking at the CARE Court, right? We need more treatment beds. We don't have enough treatment beds, whether it's mental health or drug addiction. We simply need more. There's just a lack of beds. There's a lack of clinicians working in it. We're at just that point, but we need more treatment beds.
Well, this week, the county board of supervisors approved two laws banning homeless encampments along the American River and Dry mm-hmm. Creek Parkways. Where do you stand on this? Because currently at the time, I mean, there's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision from Boise that you can't criminalize or encampments if there aren't enough spaces for people. There's not enough shelter for people. And clearly, there's not only not enough shelter, there's not enough resources.
So it's a really challenging question and how you balance everything. So I've read the Boise decision several times. And I encourage people to read the decision. I do it because I'm a lawyer. That's what we do. We read cases. But when you read through the case, the Boise decision says, bottom line, it says, you can't outlaw camping all the time in all places. So let me say that again. You can't do it all the time in all places. Now, you can do it some of the time in some places. So when you look at it, it is a limited decision in that sense. So you can do it in some of the times in some places, but you can't do it all the time in all places unless you have shelter. And it's this balance where we have compassion and we're getting treatment. But the other side of it, and I'll give an example, you have levees. You have levees out in the Tomas that protect an entire community. You have levees along the river. And sometimes you have people, what do you do if somebody is burrowing into the levee and they're undermining the levee? And I know that we don't have a lot of rain right now, but there'll come a time and a place where you have that, where you have fires that are set. So how do you balance out the environmental damage and the public safety issue of damaging the infrastructure and the levee with compassion as well, right? It's that balancing factor of all those things where, yes, we need more treatment beds. Yes, we need more shelter. But at the same time, we also have to balance where you can't have the levee being undermined, because that just, you'd have flooding downtown. You have flooding here.
You're also going to be working in tandem with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office, mm-hmm. and this is a new era. We also have Sheriff-elect Jim Cooper. What conversations have you been having with him?
So a couple of conversations. I've known Sheriff-elect Cooper for many years. He was in the Sheriff's Department first, and I think he was also the mayor at one point, I think, in Elk Grove.
He was.
And then he went to the Assembly. So I've worked with Slim Cooper on a number of different bills and things, and so I think we'll have a collaborative working experience. And my thing is, I'm a very bottom line sort of person. I can talk to anybody, work with anybody, and I want to just get stuff done. And that's kind of my goal. And I want to just open conversations with people. And I want honest opinions about things, even if they vehemently disagree with me, because that may open my mind. It may change my mind. It may give me another perspective. And at the end of the day, I may or may not agree with it, but I think we are all the better by engaging in dialogue and discussion with each other and working with each other. I'm fond of saying that a rising tide lifts all ships, and that's what we are. We need to lift each other up together.
District Attorney-elect Hope, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, as always, and please let me know if you ever want me to come back.
January 2024.
All right. Thank you.
1 year in.
All right. Thank you very much.
Sacramento County District Attorney-elect Tian Ho will be sworn in this coming January. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Color Purple is an iconic Pulitzer Prize-winning book written by Alice Walker that speaks about the power of hope, perseverance, and cyclical generational trauma. The novel was adapted into a Tony Award-winning musical by Marsha Norman. And Broadway at Music Circus will produce the highly acclaimed musical for the very first time. Joining us is Christina Acosta Robinson, who plays Shug Avery, and Ken Robinson, playing Albert, also known as Mista. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for making the trip. I just want to get this out of the way, a little bit of a backstory. Your husband and wife, you met at Yale School of Drama.
Yes.
Do the two of you perform together regularly?
Yes, actually. Well, lately we've been performing a lot together. And at first, we never planned it that way.
No.
And then I think people started to get the story that we are married, yeah. And then now we're working together all the time.
And we just look so good together.
I mean,
stage.
You do look so good. I'm kind of sad this is radio right now. So, the fact that both of you are playing love interests as well, obviously, yes. Shug Avery and Albert, how does that dynamic, I guess, how do you approach that dynamic as a married couple playing different characters that are also love interests, which is an also complicated love dynamic?
Yeah. We trust each other, you know, having been married for 12 years and having known Christina as an actor for even longer, you know, there is no one I trust more on stage than I trust her. And it's really easy.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
We don't have to do that extra work of,
no.
you know, trying to create any kind of chemistry or any yeah. kind of backstory, because we have our own and we bring that without trying to the story.
So it's easy to do, and hopefully it's easy to watch as well. You know?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Ken, you also did The Color Purple on Broadway.
I did,
that
yeah.
That is amazing. How is this yeah. production going to be different at Broadway at Music Circus?
Oh my God, I was just talking to one of the consultants, and I was just saying how, because we're in the middle of the rehearsal process now, and I was saying how immersive it is, and
In the round,
yes. at the Music Circus, Sacramento Music Circus, on Broadway, you know, it's a traditional proscenium, so you got to watch. But with this production, you're in it. You are in this world.
The audience is in it. We're coming down the aisles.
Yes.
They're seeing it from all angles.
All angles.
It's really, yeah. and it's a perfect show to do that.
That's right. That's yeah. right. And it's not something you traditionally associate with. Mm-hmm. Immersion, you know, you just kind of like watch it and it's, you know, it's pretty and moving. But this one, I think you really get inside and feel a lot more.
What message do you think this musical, how do you think it resonates most with today's audiences?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a story of finding your own strength and value. Celie goes through a lot, and we have been through a lot these last 2 years. And this character, she has gone through a lot. We learn all the traumatic things that she's been through. And by the end, you just see her stepping into her own value as a human being and learning and discovering who she is and finding her strength despite everything she's been through. She finds that that's something she can use to build herself, to make herself stronger and move forward. It's just so beautiful. Yeah. It's so inspiring.
I would also add to that, one of the things I love in the musical that was certainly a lot more present in Alice Walker's book is that no one is just one thing. And I think, you know, with the murder of George Floyd and the whole enlightening that the country and particularly theater is going through, we are all coming to realize what Bryan Stevenson often says is that we are more than the worst thing we've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking from the character of Mister, mm-hmm. who undergoes his own transformation, I think Alice Walker is really encouraging us to acknowledge that all of us are more than the worst things mm-hmm. that we've done.
Yeah, yes. I mean, Ken, you're playing a character that, you know, some would view as a villain who
yes.
could be incredibly cruel.
Yeah.
Where did you find the humanity in Mister?
You know, in the book, in the book. And thank you for mentioning that, because, you know, it's so easy to dismiss the bad guys and, you know, just to write them off as bad. But every person, every human has a story, especially those that we want least to identify with. So really, you know, I had to go to the book and I really had to go inside myself. You know, I may not have abused my wife or anyone like that, but I've done some bad things. And surely I want to be redeemed from them. I want to do what I can to get past them. And I just had to look inside. So I'm really hoping that people get that from this production.
Yeah, I mean, the characters are just so layered, and Shug Avery is perceived initially as a woman with questionable morals, and it becomes clearer throughout The Color Purple that she's a compassionate, independent woman. How did you approach this character?
Well, this is my second time doing the part. I did it 8 years ago, and revisiting it, it's just so wonderful to just dig deeper. I love doing this part. I think that, just like Ken said, that we're more than the worst things we've ever done. I think that applies to Shug Avery as well. So she inspires Celie, I think, to find her womanness, to step into her strength and her sexuality, and she's a real gift to Celie, and I think to Mister, he loves her for some reason. So you know, I found, you know, you got to find those reasons why people love. You know, there's a line, everybody loves Shug, so it's not hard to find those things in her. They're in there. You'll see when you see the show.
Yeah. And I mean, The Color Purple is just so powerful. And that, I mean, I go back to even when I watched the movie as a child, mm-hmm. when preparing for this segment, and all those same feelings that I had as a child watching the film comes back. Yeah. It's something that transcends, you know, print to film and now music. What do you think music adds to The Color Purple?
I think music adds the emotion. You know, we don't traditionally think of the first movie as a musical, because it was a drama.
Yeah.
But there was so much music in the movie, and the musical got to really go back to the book, the original source, and pull more from that the movie wasn't able to do. So I really think that the original music in this musical adds emotion.
Movement.
Yes. And space, and you know that the movie, when you're watching it on the screen, just cannot do. It adds that humanity that you can only get with live theater.
Thank you both so much for joining us, Christina and Ken. Mm-hmm. And The Color Purple will actually debut next week, August 23rd to 28th. Christina Acosta-Robison plays Shug Avery, and Ken Robison plays Mista. Yes. And Broadway at Music Circus will produce the highly acclaimed musical, as I mentioned, next week. And we have all of that information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
Like a waterfall, all a part of me, like the color purple. Where do it come from? Open up your eyes, look what God has done.
You better get back. Your husband probably wondering where you are.
Where you want to be, Celie?
With you.